Iran's president says that Tehran is determined to expand ties with Latin American states, particularly with Venezuela. Scores of settlers break into the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the occupied East Al-Quds under the protection of Israeli forces. And the coronavirus crisis in Russia shows no sign of letting up as the country records a new all-time high in its cases. I'm Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Now, top story this hour, Iran saying it's pursuing the policy of expanding relations with countries in the Latin American region. President Ibrahim Raisi says Tehran is seeking to expand relations with nations that stand against hegemonic powers. Raisi said the development of ties with Latin American countries is among Iran's diplomatic and economic priorities. The president said that Tehran and Caracas need to have long-term plans to improve bilateral ties. Raisi made those comments in a meeting with the visiting Venezuelan foreign minister. In the meantime, Iranian foreign minister said that Tehran and Caracas are set to sign a 20-year cooperation agreement soon.
In the coming months, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro will travel to Tehran, and during his visit, Iran and Venezuela will sign a 20-year cooperation agreement. It proves that bilateral ties between Tehran and Caracas are on a developing path.
Amir Abdullahian expressed Tehran's readiness to expand ties with Venezuela in all fields, including energy and technology. The top diplomat also slammed the U.S. for pursuing a hostile policy against Caracas. Venezuelan Foreign Minister Felix Plasencia Gonzalez expressed hope that Tehran and Caracas could draw a roadmap to expand their long-term cooperation. Now, commentator Marcus Papadopoulos says that a strategic partnership between Venezuela and Iran is a matter of concern for the United States. At once Caracas in its sphere of influence.
In recent years, Latin America has witnessed the formation of a strategic partnership between Venezuela and Iran. For policymakers in Washington, this is an increasingly worrying development in Latin America, because of course, historically, Latin America is America's backyard, so to speak. It is America's sphere of influence. Washington will look to try and destabilize the strategic partnership that Iran has with Venezuela.
Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has criticized the U.S. for what he calls the kidnapping of an envoy.
Saab was taken yesterday, skirting over everything. A plane arrived, assassins, hitmen came down. They sought him out and they removed him with blows from the jail he was held. They took him without advising lawyers, the family, nobody. A kidnapping by the United States government of an international diplomat.
Maduro says that the U.S. violated all international rights by taking Alex Saab. He said that his extradition was one of the most ignoble and vulgar injustices committed in recent decades. A Colombian national, Saab is charged in the U.S. with running a network that allegedly exploited food aid destined for Venezuela. He was extradited to the U.S. from Cape Verde and is due to appear in court on Monday. Saab's lawyers have called the move politically motivated. He himself said that he will not collaborate with Washington. Caracas has suspended talks with the opposition on ending the political crisis in Venezuela. Tehran says it's firm in its decision to resume negotiations for the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal. However, it rejects the approach of talks for the sake of talks. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says that Iran has not set any precondition for the resumption of the negotiations. He said that talks are underway with European parties in Brussels on issues that remain unresolved during the Vienna negotiations. Khatibzadeh stressed Iran needs to see a change in the U.S. policy, saying it wants it to remove anti-Iran sanctions and stop bullying Tehran. Khatibzadeh says that Tehran has not seen any such action from Washington yet. Another act of Israeli provocation against the Palestinian people and desecration of their holy sites. Scores of Israeli settlers have stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the occupied East Al-Quds. The break-in was carried out under the protection of Israeli forces. The settlers performed prayers in the courtyards of the mosque and took pictures. Israeli officials have been allowing settler incursions into the mosque compound since 2003 under the protection of security forces. Non-Muslim prayers are prohibited at the site under an agreement between Israel and Jordan, that's the custodian of the holy sites in Al-Quds. Back in May, Israeli violence against Palestinian worshippers led to an 11-day war between Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza and the Tel Aviv regime. Some 260 Palestinians were killed in that conflict. In the meantime, Israeli settlers' attacks against Palestinian farmers and their lands have been on the rise since the beginning of the olive harvest season. To protect Palestinian farmers, a campaign has been launched by activists in areas considered to be at high risk of Israeli settler attacks.
The olive harvest season has started in the occupied Palestinian territories, but instead of being a festive season, it's been overshadowed by the sporadic attacks by Israeli settlers like previous years. Press TV visited the village of Al-Mghayyar, northeast of the occupied Ramallah, where Israeli settlers vandalized over 100 olive trees a while ago. One of the landowners told us that settler attacks on the groves have escalated during the autumn harvesting season.
The settlers do whatever in their power to prevent us from harvesting. They till our crops, destroy our lands, and sometimes burn our trees. They try to keep us away from our lands. 2 days ago, over 100 olive trees were destroyed. The settlers are protected by Israeli forces.
As Palestinian farmers here and other villages suffer an almost daily act of aggression by Israeli settlers, a popular campaign called Faza has been launched to protect farmers. These areas are considered to be at high risk of settler attacks during the harvest season. Supported by the Committee Against the Woolland Settlement, the campaign has attracted volunteers including university students, farming committees, local councils, and residents of the villages. The vandalism by the extremist settlers have persisted year after year during the olive harvest season in recent years. Observers say these settlements have been set up to encircle Palestinian areas to make life harder for Palestinians. Olive harvest has never been easy for Palestinian families living close to Israeli settlements. Olive harvest is considered by many of them as a way to stay connected to their land and protect it against the Israelis. This land has been a source of food and income for Palestinian families for generations. Mona Kandil, Al-Mghayyar village, northeast of occupied Ramallah.
Israeli prison authorities have reportedly refused to stop harsh restrictions against Palestinian inmates, and that has led to more prisoners joining a hunger strike to protest against the tough conditions. We've discussed that issue with our guests in our news review program.
Talks between Palestinian inmates and Israeli prison authorities over harsh conditions inside jails have reportedly collapsed. According to Palestinian media, the negotiations broke down due to the Israeli refusal to accept some of the prisoners' demands. The regime has been treating Palestinian prisoners harshly since last month when six inmates escaped a heavily guarded Israeli jail. Over 400 Palestinians in Israeli prisons are on hunger strike in protest at punitive measures, with more joining them. The Islamic Jihad movement has warned that it will not shy away from going to war with the Israeli regime to defend the prisoners. Joining us is Charlotte Cates from the Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network from Vancouver. And we also have Henry Herskovitz, an anti-Israel peace activist from Ann Arbor. Welcome, Charlotte. If I could start with you. I mean, rights groups already say Palestinian prisoners experience harsh conditions in Israeli jails. Is any idea what additional punitive measures that Israel has imposed on Palestinian prisoners?
Certainly. After what's been called the Freedom Tunnel operation, that is six Palestinian prisoners who used, you know, every single tool that they could find at hand, from, you know, spoons to pens inside their cell, to dig a tunnel to freedom outside the heavily fortified Israeli colonial Gilboa prison, winning their freedom and obtaining the support and solidarity of Palestinians throughout Palestine and around the world and all people of conscience, and also really exposing the weakness of Israel's, you know, much touted and marketed security technologies. Since the six prisoners and their fellow brothers among the Islamic Jihad prisoners have been recaptured, they have been subjected to torture, isolation, harsh interrogation. They've been separated from one another. They've been repeatedly transferred from prison to prison. The six themselves were subject to harsh physical interrogation, torture, sleep deprivation, ongoing attacks to attempt to wear them down and break their will, which their will has refused to be broken. The Islamic Jihad prisoners in particular were basically deprived of all of the very limited rights, all of which have been obtained through decades of struggle among the Palestinian prisoners and among the Palestinian prisoners' movement, including hunger strikes, organized actions, and movement building inside the prison in cooperation with the Palestinian resistance outside prison. And so this attack on the Islamic Jihad prisoners, where there are now 250 on hunger strike to demand an end to these kinds of measures, isn't an attack on just this set of prisoners, but on all of the struggles throughout the past decades and decades of Palestinian prisoners organizing to have the ability to not be forced to labor or to stay with one another and with their comrades and brothers in their own political organizations. And so this is just one attempt after another, from cutting the supply of water to the prisons, to refusing to allow books into the prisons, to cutting off family visits, to cutting off legal visits. Israel's constantly engaged in a war against the Palestinian political prisoners, and Palestinian prisoners are engaged in constant resistance with their bodies and lives on the front lines every day confronting the jailers. And so this struggle that's taking place right now, it is really for the rights and dignity of all 4,650 Palestinian political prisoners inside Israeli jails.
Henry, do you see this harsh conditions that Israel has imposed on the Palestinian prisoners as a response to the it was quite an embarrassing prison break for the Israeli authorities? You had six Palestinians escaping essentially with a spoon from a heavily fortified Israeli prison. Is this a collective punishment by Israel? Do you see it as that?
Well, I certainly see it as a collective punishment. And collective punishment is such a cruel punishment because it doesn't affect the people who are purportedly guilty. But the cruelty is just completely symbolic of the entire Jewish Zionist regime that has invaded Palestine for the last 80 years and continues on with the genocide of the Palestinian people. It would all be decried as a racist regime. And yet somehow, I think due to the manipulation and domination of our press media, that these concepts don't get out to the regular people. And to me, the cruelty is really magnified when they go after the families of the prisoners and punish the families. But again, the cruelty that is exemplified in these actions is just a reflection of the cruelty of an entire movement that would seek to invade and displace one people for another people.
Okay, I'm afraid time has gotten the better of us. Let me thank our guest, Charlotte Cates from the Samedun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network. They're joining us from Vancouver, and Henry Herskovitz, an anti-Israel peace activist from Ann Arbor. Thank you for staying tuned to another edition of the News Review.
Now let's take a look at some COVID news. The number of cases in Russia has topped 8 million amid a sluggish vaccination in that country. Health officials reported more than 34,000 infections in the past day. This is the highest single-day case tally. Russia also reported nearly 1,000 daily deaths, pushing the tally to over 224,000. Russia has been fighting a new wave of infections in recent weeks, which has forced the health ministry to ask retired vaccinated medics to return to hospitals. The officials blamed the surge on the people's reluctance to get vaccinated. Just nearly 33% of the population has received jabs. Nigeria's top cleric, Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zakzaki, and his wife have sued the country's government over the seizure of their passports. The two each filed for damages of over $4.8 million at a federal high court of Nigeria and demanded a release of their documents. The leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria and his wife argue that the confiscation of their travel documents violates their fundamental right to freedom of movement and is illegal. Couples say that the government is endangering their lives by refusing to allow them to travel abroad for medical treatment. Zakzaki and his wife were detained in December 2015 after a deadly crackdown on the Islamic movement in Nigeria. They were released in July this year after a court acquitted them of all the charges. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Dear youth, prepare yourselves for the era of Imam Mahdi. The 22nd of May, 2016. Immense oppression that prevails throughout the world. The unjust domination, the hounding of nations around the globe, excessive bloodshed, the disregard of the most noble and the most beloved of human values. This is the treachery that the global supercilious front presents to mankind day after day. Immense immorality, exploitation, and oppression naturally strikes at one who does not have a spring of hope to cling on to, with hopelessness. This is how younger generations in Western countries are driven to nihilism. The new generation which has not adapted to nor abides by the traditions, when they see the turbulence of mankind's living environment, they lose hope. Thus, they are driven into nihilism. Many girls and boys in Western countries are driven to into nihilism, which is the manifestation of vapidity and ignorance that have sunk them into a lifestyle of fleeting passions. However, the nation that is optimistic about the future knows that these times will come to an end. An era will emerge when the mighty power of justice will eradicate all summits of corruption and oppression. A new era that will enlighten humankind's outlook with the light of justice. This is what the awaiting era of Imam Mahdi, our Saviour, signifies. Dear adolescents, you are at the start of your endeavours in life.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
You should work hard to prepare the ground for a new era. The era wherein there is no form of injustice and oppression. Prepare for an era wherein the deliberation and wisdom of mankind become more active, more creative, and more innovative than any other time. Prepare for the era wherein nations do not launch wars on each other, because the warmongers of the world, those who staged regional and global wars in the past and present, will no longer have the ability to wage wars. Absolute peace and security will prevail around the globe. One must work hard towards that era. Before the era of the awaited Saviour, there will be no ease. One cannot seek comfort and tranquility.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address the most important issues in the South Asian region. What's going on? Who are the key actors involved? What are the people saying? And how are the issues changing the future? All of this will be answered with the help of our team of experts and guests. So stay tuned.
In this edition of the subcontinent, we are going to take a look at Afghanistan, where Daesh killed more than 100 Shia Muslims by bombing a mosque. And we will discuss how Britain's actions hundreds of years ago are responsible for conflict between China and India today.
On October 8, 2021, a Daesh suicide attack claimed the lives of almost 100 Shia Muslims and left several others wounded. The residents who were travelling to the mosque in the northern Afghan city of Kunduz probably had no idea that they might not return. Or maybe they did. Shias have for long been targeted by Daesh. The Shias in Afghanistan in particular are easy to identify. This is because the Shia sect in Afghanistan is followed predominantly by the third largest ethnic group in Afghanistan, the Hazara.
In 1880, the Hazara community was comprised of landed nobility, peasants and artisans. Now the Hazara community focuses on how to survive and not get killed. The reason is simple. The Hazara predominantly follow the Shia sect of Islam, and as the third largest ethnicity in Afghanistan, they live in ghettos. Because they live in ghettos and because their facial features are distinct from other Pashtuns, they become easy targets. Being Shia and therefore both a religious and a visible ethnic minority, Hazaras are particularly vulnerable. Even before the October 8 bombing, suicide bombings targeting Hazara public events have taken place with increasing regularity, most of which have been claimed by groups stating allegiance with Daesh. These include, in July 2016, the killing of 85 people at a peaceful protest comprised of mostly Hazaras. It was the deadliest attack on civilians since 2002 and targeted the Hazara on the basis of their Shia religious identity. Other attacks include a December 2017 bombing that left at least 41 dead and another 80 injured in a Hazara neighborhood of western Kabul, and an assault in March 2018 that resulted in the deaths of at least 9 people. So why are Shias a problem? Well, right after the Iranian Revolution of 1979, the West and allies had feared that the Iranian revolutionary spirit was spread beyond borders. The revolution was religious in nature, thus part of anti-Iran training, which was fueled by billions of Saudi petrodollars and West-made ammo, included propaganda against Shiism directly. Daesh and Al-Qaeda fighters were taught that followers of the Shia sect of Islam were infidels, and thus they not only had a license to kill these people, who followed the same sect of Islam as Iranians were following, but were encouraged to do so.
There is confusion as how Daesh suddenly became active again, just after the US left and just after China announced its support for infrastructure projects in Afghanistan. As Taliban officials shift from leading an insurgency to forming a functioning state, the Islamic State is trying to undercut Taliban's promises, and it clearly seems that there is reason beyond hate. For the US, using proxies to create instability is like a walk in the park. The Taliban now are from the same freedom fighters which the US supported in Afghanistan for its war against the invading USSR. When former US President calls former President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton the co-founders of Daesh, maybe that's the only statement from Trump which is relevant here.
Daesh remained diminished from its zenith. However, since the Taliban came to power after 20 years of conflict, Daesh's Levant Khorasan ISIL-K sector has revived. According to a letter from the chair of the United Nations Security Council, the terrorist group has come forward with a new, ambitious leader called Shahab al-Muhajir. The group is now active and dangerous and positions itself as the sole pure rejectionist group in Afghanistan to sway the hate mongers in Afghanistan among its ranks. This reminisces with how Daesh first came into scene. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad formed a stronger alliance with Russia and Iran. Rebels and Daesh sprung up in the region to take control. Iranian General Qasem Soleimani takes down Daesh in the region. US targets him and kills him in a cold-blooded act of war. Now that the Taliban have come to take control after humiliating the US, and now that they have joined hands with China, Daesh suddenly re-emerges with astute sophistication in Afghanistan. After the Taliban cleaned up the chaos created by US in Afghanistan, China announced $31 million in emergency aid to the war-ridden country in order to help its people. Furthermore, according to Global Times, a member of the Chinese business group in Kabul said that they have already made agreements with domestic enterprises and other organizations to jointly build a platform in Kabul will provide services like personnel safety, government liaisoning, and bank exchange, tax and logistical services to the Afghan Institute, according to Global Times. With rehabilitation plans and bloc formation of China, Pakistan, Iran, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan, the US definitely faces a checkmate situation when it comes to geostrategic power struggle in the South Asian arena, and it seems as though Daesh is the last breath which US can take before its influence completely drowns in the region.
Now, for more insight, we are joined by Mr. Mustafa Ariyai from the Netherlands. He is an author at Covert Action magazine. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Ariyai.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Now, could you begin by telling us more on the recent suicide bombing, which killed almost 100 Shia Hazara Muslims in Afghanistan, and who seems to benefit from this horrific act of violence?
And with your permission, I would like to express my sorrow and condolences to the family, to my Afghan compatriots. And I would also like to obviously condemn this inhumane attack against innocent civilians in the strongest terms possible. Unfortunately, this is an ongoing effort to destabilize Afghanistan. And we have seen in the past attacks that targeted both Shiite and non-Shiite groups in the country, defenseless people throughout the country. And these terrorist attacks were mostly indiscriminate by nature. And this has only fueled sectarian violence in the country. And that is exactly what the terrorists try to achieve.
So do you think Daesh's aims are religious or are they political?
I think they're mostly, their convictions are mostly political, but unfortunately they are abusing religion convictions to justify their aim. Daesh is they're a hardcore Salafist group of terrorists supported and backed by the Gulf states, the Persian Gulf monarchies. They have poured billions upon billions of dollars to bring about such a infamous group of terrorists called Daesh, and their aspirations are very simple. They abuse Islam, and their version of Islam, so to speak, is the one that doesn't allow for any interpretation. They're not very different from what the Taliban is or used to be. They are very strict in their ideology, because let's call for what it is. They're rather an ideology than that they have anything to do with the religion of Islam, which is a very peaceful religion full of serenity. But Daesh, we have seen what they did in Syria. We have seen what they did in Iraq, killing innocent people, beheading people, even organ eating. Terrorists were seen in different footages. So suspicion is bound to arise. They have political aspirations. They want a full-spec domination of Central Asian region. And hadn't it been for countries like Iran, Russia, and China, you know, they could have pretty well achieved their aim, which, God willing, will never happen.
there one last question. How do you see this unfolding in the future?
Well, I always tell to many friends that the suffering of the Afghan people has been immense, ongoing. Unless there is a genuine effort by the international community to stand with the Afghan people and to stop this insecurity in the country. Right now, Afghanistan is facing a huge crisis, food shortage, hunger, famine, you name it. Unless there is the world doesn't act to support the Afghan nation, I'm afraid things will only get from bad to worse. And you also mentioned the rivalry between great powers. I hope that that will come to a speedy and unconditional end, because Afghanistan and the Afghan nation are the ultimate victims.
Mr. Ariyari, thank you for your precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how the people have reacted on social media and cyberspace.
Afghan-Australian scholar and writer Farahonda Akbar says a new shade of narrative is emerging in post-Taliban takeover of Afghanistan about the unending saga of Hazara tragedies, an issue she believes has always been politicized. Salim Javad, a Gothenburg-based Afghan activist and writer, refers to the Uyghur identity of the suicide bomber in Kunduz, noting that his facial features resembling Hazaras made it difficult to prevent his entry to the mosque. Stanford University lecturer Mehdi Hakimi condemns the criminal silence of political leaders in Afghanistan over the massacre of Hazara Shias in Kunduz, saying it sends the wrong message to terrorists.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
India and China share an ill-defined 3,440-kilometer-long disputed border. Rivers, lakes, and snow caps along the frontier mean the line can shift, bringing soldiers face-to-face at many points, sparking a confrontation. There is a line of actual control where opposing troops maintain their positions and control with it, something like an informal border where both countries are racing to build infrastructure to legitimize control, such as India's construction of a new road to a high-altitude airbase which sparked a conflict in June 2020. The border conflict is extremely important and crucial to resolve, as it has sparked a war between both countries in 1962. But both neighbors are armed with nuclear weapons, and we need to critically analyze really why the conflict exists in the first place.
According to the Economic Times, on 30th of August 2021, close to 100 soldiers of China's People's Liberation Army, PLA, crossed 5 kilometers across the line of actual control, or LAC, last month. The Chinese troops returned after a few hours from the area, guarded by the Indo-Tibetan Border Police, ITBP, so there was no standoff. Even earlier, anti-China sentiments in India were gaining momentum since the flare-up of the border dispute between the two countries last year at Galwan Valley, the first time in 45 years that soldiers died in a standoff between India and China. In April 2020, India moved to curb foreign investment from neighboring countries. These initiatives were taken in a bid to primarily stop Chinese companies from acquiring smaller and financially vulnerable Indian companies. The ultimate goal was to prevent, quote, predatory investments in these companies, particularly from China. A broad movement of anti-Chinese consumerism occurring inside India was also heightened with US former President Trump's visit to India. But very few actually know the reason for this conflict and havoc. Britain ruled over the South Asian region countries for about 200 years, before which the East India Company had already rid the region of its riches. The subcontinent region's global economic share dropped from 25% when they took control to merely 2% when they left. Having control over countries like India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, as well as parts of Afghanistan and China, the British ruled with a divide-and-rule policy wherein they employed division tactics between the people based on religion, political ideas, language, ethnicity, and even skin color. The aim was simple: to keep these people in conflict with each other so that the colonizers could keep control and steal riches meanwhile.
The people of the subcontinent were getting tired and frustrated of the British rule. Despite failed wars of independence and promises of independence on support of allies during the two world wars, the British did not leave. But after stealing away most of the riches of India and having been faced with a new independence movement spearheaded by leaders like Gandhi, the British were finally forced to leave. The British left the region but made sure that their colonial footprint and influence remained. Power players like China, India and Pakistan were forced to get stuck in a quagmire because of British policies.
After the British left the subcontinent, there were three conflicts to resolve. One was between Pakistan and India over Jammu and Kashmir, one was between Pakistan, India and China over Ladakh, and one was between India and China in the Tibetan region of Arunachal Pradesh. During the time British had control over India, the provinces which we see currently in Pakistan, India and Bangladesh were in actual princely states ruled mostly by the favorites of the British Empire who paid taxes to the Empire and showed unquestionable loyalty. The British left it in the hands of the princes of the states to decide which countries they wanted to join. At that time, there were two, India and Pakistan. After the British left, it is inconclusive as to whether Maharaja Singh of Kashmir joined India or Pakistan. War broke out between India and Pakistan in 1948 for control of Kashmir, and both established line of control in disputed Kashmir areas, a conflict which exists till this day. When the issue came between Pakistan and China over Shaksgam Valley and areas in Ladakh, both countries settled it, and while this territory was ceded to China, China also ceded 1,942 square kilometers territory to Pakistan. This was not recognized by India, which still calls the land its own. Now, regarding China and India, here is the story. While in control, the British Empire redrew the border lines as they saw fit according to their own interests. Initially, in 1897, the British added the Aksai Chin region in the Kashmir province and transferred it to the Prince of Kashmir. However, in 1899, the British gave the same Aksai Chin region to China. India stuck with claims to 1897 lines, while China stuck with lines drawn for China in 1899. Thus, the confusion. With both countries stuck to the different boundary lines, both claimed Aksai Chin theirs. This was ultimately followed by the Indo-China War in 1962, where India lost some of its territories while China fermented its control in Aksai Chin. The strife between India and Pakistan and India and China run till this day.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Binoy Kampmark, an author and columnist for The Mandarin. Now, welcome to the program, Mr. Kampmark. First of all, could you explain what the situation is between China and India? What is the border dispute all about, and where does it stand currently?
Well, just as a general kind of thing, of course, many of your listeners and viewers would be aware that there's been a dispute, of course, between China and India that has been going on essentially since Indian independence, and also with China's turning over, as it were, to communism, of course, with Mao Zedong. But the significant thing that relates to the current border situation goes right back to 1962, that there was a border dispute which resulted actually in a war. And the war, of course, over Himalayan provinces, and that resulted in a very heavy Indian defeat. And in a sense, that has left a very bad taste in the mouth of Indian officials. It's also meant that both these powers have been in constant rivalry. And the reason why there are issues lately of significance is because both sides have been developing infrastructure, almost teasing and taunting each other on either sides, as it were, in the Galwan Valley, the Ladakh area, as it's called, and have resulted, as it were, in some fatal clashes that took place last year. So there have been these sporadic clashes, but also recent meetings that have not been successful in resolving this particular dispute.
Now, can you tell us a bit more about the background and the role that the British Empire played in all of this?
Well, I mean, the important thing about this, of course, is that the British, as they have done in other parts of the world, have left a very ambiguous legacy in terms of borders, because one of the things that we see in terms of Tibet and in terms of the outlying territorial aspects, if you like, between India and China, are these ambiguous, you know, demarcations, which is very significant. In fact, individuals such as the British officer Henry McMahon famously demarcated a border in 1914 in Tibet. This is not a border that's accepted very much by the Chinese, but it's one of significance. The same thing with other officials associated with the British East India Company. They were very famous, of course, in jotting and charting borders in terms of whether powers would observe them or not. But of course, in the aftermath of the British leaving India, and then of course with the event that, you know, with the arrival of Mao Zedong, this almost became redundant. But that legacy, if you like, the territorial legacy, still lingers in terms of disputes over borders.
So the British can say they already left. Why haven't China and India resolved their border disputes, and why haven't Pakistan and India resolved their own border disputes?
Well, I suppose in a sense all of them are linked, because Pakistan itself being an outgrowth of partition, and Indian, you know, the result of course, India failing to resolve its internal differences, and a lot of this being attributed also to British foreign policy. I don't necessarily think it should be attributed exclusively to the British, but nonetheless it's important to appreciate. And of course also the Chinese remembering foreign policy depredations in terms of how they were treated in terms of Western powers. So you've got India, you've got Pakistan, you've got China, and in a sense all these individual countries are jousting or trying to find some kind of equilibrium in the region. And so the British legacy still remains, and, you know, Britain itself doesn't necessarily have much of a direct hand, but they certainly have much of a hand in terms of their legacy in disputing territories and so forth. Certainly when it comes to, you know, matters and, you know, as simple as border posts, as simple as, you know, the Aksai Chin Plateau and these areas, the British influence is still very much there.
Thank you, Mr. Kampmark. So glad to have you here on the program. Now, let's see how the people have reacted on social media and cyberspace.
Brahma Chelene, a New Delhi-based strategic thinker and commentator, says the Himalayas have become the most dangerous flashpoint in the Indo-Pacific region amidst escalating tensions between regional rivals India and China. Former Bangladeshi army official and diplomat Shahidul Haq points to blame games between India and China, which he says has made efforts to negotiate a way out of the ongoing border row between them increasingly difficult.
And that was our episode on the devastating bombing in Afghanistan and colonial roots in present issues of the subcontinent. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to the listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, an analysis on the thoughts and speeches of the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Sadiq and Brother Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa
rahmatullah.
Very welcome to the show, Viewpoints. So regarding the speeches of the leader of Iran on the concept of human being, and the we can say the most important speeches that the rahbar gave on the role that the human being might have in today's world, there have been a series of discussions, and we try to get into the different dimensions and angles of the life of the human beings. So for today's discussion, we want to be concerned with a very important topic as tackled by the leader of the Islamic Ummah, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, and that is the position of men and women in Islam. Especially the Western world has got misunderstood the position of women. And the women are looking after the rights in the wrong picture that has been made for them. Because the women nowadays, especially in the feminism and the feminist look that they have, are looking for the instrumental look of the men too. And this is absolutely the materialistic look, the bodily physical look that the men and women have at each other and are looking after their own rights in this framework. And just take a look at what is happening in today's world. For example, Me Too movement. You know, these are the women who are looking after their rights because they have been abused, misused, or raped, you know, especially in the cinematic form or by the artists here and there. This is not only limited, of course, to the actresses, but all the women, you know, in different classes of the society. And the major question is this: when you wanted to get into the industry, by any means, weren't you thinking about this? That you are an absolute instrument of the play and power? Now you're gonna, now we're gonna make a movement, say Me Too. I have been raped and I have been abused by the men. And you know, just take a look at this, that the men also claiming this too, okay? You know, this is really funny, you know, what's happening around us in today's world. And just look that how much the people are affected by the power of the media. I mean, how limited a look of the women and men in today's world must be at the best creature of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on earth. That this is the men and this is the women, and they have been limited their powers, their rights, this and that. Based on what? Based on sexuality and based on sexual desires or this and that. Is this why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala created us? I mean, the power that He put us in us?
Regarding the Me Too movement, your response is basically blaming the victim, Right? You should have thought about this before.
I'm not blaming I'm not blaming the victim. I said they are the victim of the policies that they have been living in.
Yeah, the thing is it's much more complicated, and you know that we're having similar movements in religious circles as well.
Yes.
Like we have this face movement and
yes.
the spiritual abuse
yes.
stuff like that even in Muslim communities. I think you know they're looking at it in a very simplistic. Oversimplified view of the problem, and at least in the Muslim community, if you want to fix the issue that is there, there's no denying that we need to still look at how religion and our scripture require us to face these issues. We cannot just make up our own rules and follow the trends to fix the problem.
So, you know, for example, from the other side, the religion of Islam is also criticized nowadays
yeah.
for not having the enough respect for the women
yeah.
and especially the women rights, okay? So what would be the answer to that one? I mean, from the Western world.
If you look at the Muslim world, right, the Muslims are a separate thing from Islam, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we don't have the perfect community. We're not in the utopia of Islam right now. So I think one of the ahadith that can give us a clue about the view of Islam is a very controversial one when you look at the surface. It's narrated that the Prophet asked his companions, "What is the best thing for women?" And Imam Ali alayhi salam went to his house, asked the same question from Sayyidah Zahra salamullah alayha.
Okay.
And Lady Zahra salamullah alayha said, "The best thing for a woman is to not see a man and not be seen by a man."
Mm-hmm.
Sounds very radical,
yes.
right? But when we look at the life of Lady Fatima salamullah alayha, that's not the case. Men used to see him, used to see her. Prophet would tell everyone, if you don't know this, this is Fatima bint Muhammad. Man adaha faqad adani. And after the decease of the Prophet, Lady Fatima came to masjid, gave a very strong lecture. So she was in the society. So what does this mean? My understanding of this hadith is women in general must be in the society. Like women have a role in society, right? But when you're in the society, when you're acting in the society, you must leave your gender behind. Leave your gender in the house. Whether you're a man or a woman, when I look at you, I must be seeing a human who is very intellectual, who's very creative,
okay.
who's very powerful.
Is it possible, Shaykh? I mean, for example, consider the, you know, according to the statistics, the women are the attractive sex and the attractive gender, and this is not only in Islam but
to
all,
heterosexual men. Yes.
You know, no, this is the absolute form, okay? That sexually speaking,
yeah, you could say they are associated more with beauty, but attractiveness is subjective.
Or beauty, or I don't know, attracting this and that, okay? But the case is that, so women with all these potentials and the powers,